Welcome to this special launch edition of Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with three leading investigators in the field to learn of recent clinical trial results, current ongoing studies, and where things are likely to head in the future. To begin, Dr. Robert Ozolz provided an overview of the key issues in current ovarian cancer control.
Unfortunately, ovarian cancer still is diagnosed in advanced stage in about 75% of the time. By that, we mean intraperitoneal carcinomatosis, stage 3 or stage 4 disease, and primarily stage 3 disease, where the disease has spread outside the ovaries, involved peritoneal structures throughout the peritoneal cavity. There has not been a good screening test for ovarian cancer, and there's nothing that can be recommended to use for screening, and consequently, there are very few specific symptoms also of the disease, so that patients often have complaint of bloating and urinary problems and maybe some constipation and are only diagnosed when they have very advanced stage disease. Almost all other solid tumors now, breast cancer, as you know, and lung cancer even with spiral CTs and breast cancer with mammographies and colon cancer with colonoscopies and prostate with PSAs, more and more patients are being diagnosed at earlier stage. But that's not the case with ovarian cancer because we don't have any really good tools for early diagnosis. And the number that everybody uses is 75% of patients are diagnosed with advanced stage disease. An initial treatment for this group of patients continues to be surgery, and the cornerstone of management is surgery, and cytoreductive surgery is important to try to remove as much disease as possible. And then patients are categorized after that surgery whether they're optimal or suboptimal, depending on how much disease there is. Suboptimal means that there are tumor nodules greater than 1 centimeter left in the peritoneal cavity, and optimal, of course, means that there is no tumor nodule greater than 1 centimeter anywhere in the peritoneal cavity. Patients who have suboptimal disease after that surgery, and right now in the United States, it's probably about 60% of patients are diagnosed with optimal disease or have optimal surgical cytoreduction after initial diagnosis, and 40% or so are suboptimal. For the suboptimal patients, everybody would agree that the standard treatment after the surgery is intravenous chemotherapy, and a two-drug combination of carboplatin plus paclitaxel is a worldwide standard for that group of patients. For the patients who have optimal stage 3 disease, there's been an issue about whether those patients should be treated with intraperitoneal therapy or intravenous therapy. And there's a legitimate debate, and well-meaning people can disagree on this. And certainly some people feel strongly that those patients should be treated with intraperitoneal therapy, and others feel that intravenous chemotherapy remains a standard of care for that group of patients. But at the end of the day, when we treat ovarian cancer, if you take 100 patients with advanced disease and after cytoreductive surgery and chemotherapy, about 75% will be in a clinical complete remission, which means their markers will be normal, their CA125 level will be normal, the CAT scan of the abdomen will be normal, and a pelvic exam will be normal. So we're very good at getting patients into a clinical complete remission. We're not so good at keeping them there. 75% of that 75% will relapse. And unfortunately, recurrent ovarian cancer is invariably fatal. We have no treatment that can really cure patients who have recurrent ovarian cancer. So we're dealing with the fact that most patients will get initial chemotherapy and most patients will require some type of recurrent therapy, a treatment for recurrent disease. And again, the mainstay for a treatment of recurrent disease will be chemotherapy. And again, we subdivide this group of patients with recurrent disease into those patients who we consider sort of platinum sensitive, which means they had a disease-free interval of at least 6 months. And we treat them with a carboplatin-based combination. And if they're platinum resistant, they recur very quickly, then we treat them with non-platinum drugs. So that's the basic approach to this group of patients. And if we look at the end of the day, have we improved survival in the long run in the last decade? Its long-term survival probably has been slightly improved. What has changed, however, is the number of patients who are living at least 5 years. We're getting more and more patients to live longer. So median survival now in patients with advanced stage disease is over 5 years. So, and the percent of patients who are alive at 5 years has increased from about 30%, that's all ovarian cancer patients, about 30% about 15 or 20 years ago now to close to 50%. So we're making progress in making it more of a chronic disease, but unfortunately, most patients ultimately will succumb to the disease.
What are the major clinical trials right now in the adjuvant setting that are being conducted?
Well, it's interesting that for a long time we debated about what were the best initial chemotherapy, and there were numerous clinical trials that were done, and the consensus finally was that in a large GOG study comparing carboplatin paclitaxel versus cisplatin paclitaxel, and that showed that carboplatin paclitaxel was better. And that, in fact, became the standard of care. But again, even though it's very effective treatment, it's an outpatient treatment. Patients get 6 cycles of this chemotherapy and, again, have a very good response rate with relatively favorable toxicity profile. They do get hair loss. They do get some neuropathy. But it's still a good, solid regimen. And then we try to do some studies and say, okay, let's take some other drugs, such as pegylated liposomal doxorubicin or Doxil or gemcitabine or topotecan, and add them to that combination of paclitaxel and carboplatin and see if that can improve survival compared to paclitaxel and carboplatin. And there was a very large study reported at ASCO a couple of years ago by Mike Bookman for the GOG with contributions from investigators throughout the world that showed that in a 4,000-patient trial that there was nothing better than the two-drug combination of paclitaxel and carboplatin. Now, there are still some other trials ongoing comparing, for example, paclitaxel carboplatin and gemcitabine carboplatin. Those studies have been, I think, completed. They may be reported at ASCO this year. And there have been other studies of adding drugs such as epirubicin as well. None of them, again, have been shown to impact as yet upon survival or improve survival compared to treatment with paclitaxel plus carboplatin. So that really remains sort of the gold standard. And unfortunately, none of the trials that we've tried to improve upon that by adding new drugs made any difference. The big research in ovarian cancer is with biological agents, and I think the very exciting studies as far as initial treatment are with trying to incorporate bevacizumab in treatment with paclitaxel and carboplatin. It's very interesting that the gynecologic oncology group did a phase 2 trial of bevacizumab in previously treated patients with recurrent ovarian cancer. And in that group of patients, there was somewhere close to a 20% response rate, which is striking because in other solid tumors where bevacizumab has been approved, it's always been approved in combination with chemotherapy. And as a single agent, bevacizumab doesn't have much activity in breast cancer, lung cancer, or colorectal cancer. It's only very effective and, again, approved by the FDA when it's used in combination in those diseases. But in ovarian cancer, it was very striking that in the 64-patient trial by the GOG, that the response rate was substantial. And furthermore, there were the 30 to 35% approximately group of patients who did not have disease progression at 6 months. So it appeared to be a very active a single agent. And consequently, there was a lot of interest that had perhaps that bevacizumab together with chemotherapy would even be better than any other solid tumors because it not only would theoretically potentiate the effects of chemotherapy as it does in those other tumors, but also because of its own individual activity. Now, there was concern that bevacizumab had some significant toxicities and gastrointestinal perforations occurred. Again, it's interesting, there were no gastrointestinal perforations in the GOG trial, but in a subsequent trial, about 10% of patients had gastrointestinal perforations. And it's unclear if we pooled all the data. It appears it doesn't take place in about 5% of patients. So it is a risk factor for use of bevacizumab in ovarian cancer. We're not quite sure exactly if we can define a group of patients in whom bevacizumab may induce these gastrointestinal perforations. We know that GIPs can also occur in other diseases where bevacizumab is used. So it's really something that we're concerned about. But we did launch, and by we, I mean the gynecologic oncology group, did launch a randomized phase 3 trial in previously untreated patients with advanced ovarian cancer as well as with primary peritoneal cancer. And those patients are randomized to 3 different regimens. The first regimen is paclitaxel carboplatin together with a placebo. The second regimen is paclitaxel carboplatin with Avastin or bevacizumab administered during the course of chemotherapy. After the first cycle, they don't get Avastin, but the 5 cycles, they do get Avastin or bevacizumab. That's in an effort to obviate any potential bleeding that may occur while the patient is recovering from surgery. So again, this is a hope that, like any other solid tumors where bevacizumab potentiated the effects of chemotherapy, and then they get maintenance with a placebo. Again, all of this is placebo. Nobody in the trial knows what they're getting. In the third arm, patients get paclitaxel on carboplatin, bevacizumab with the chemotherapy, as well as bevacizumab maintenance therapy for 14 months. So it's asking the question, does bevacizumab potentiate the effects of chemotherapy compared to paclitaxel on carboplatin? And does it make a difference if you continue the bevacizumab as sort of a maintenance therapy in this disease? So that's a very exciting study. It's well on its way by the GOG, and as far as I know, the gastrointestinal perforations that we're looking at very carefully have not been a major problem in previously untreated patients. So I think that is the key study. There are some concerns that it is a placebo-controlled, so if you're randomized to the placebo arm, you get not only placebo during the chemotherapy, but you have to come back for 14 months of placebo treatment. But it is accruing. I think that study will let us know whether bevacizumab impacts upon survival and progression-free survival when combined with paclitaxel and carboplatin.
It's interesting. I don't know whether you know this. I was actually interviewing Mike O'Connell from the NSABP about their adjuvant bevacizumab colon trial. And it was interesting. He was telling me some stuff that they're actually submitting, I think, for next year's ASCO. But essentially, he told me that they did not see or they have not seen an increased risk of perforation in the adjuvant setting yet, or they haven't seen that. I don't know whether you're aware of that or what you think about that.
Well, that may be the case. It may be that in recurrent disease, after patients have had multiple surgeries and they've got tumor around the bowel, that may be the group of patients in whom the gastrointestinal perforations may be at a high risk. So in an adjuvant situation where, you know, they're better debulked and, you know, there's not a lot of disease, that group of patients may be the ones where you don't get the gastrointestinal perforations.
What do we know about the pathophysiology of the perforations that are seen with ovarian cancer? Again, my take when I started to see this come out in the metastatic colon setting was that usually these weren't really catastrophic events. Sometimes they were sort of minor, but it wasn't, even though it was a concerning problem clinically, that these were not huge problems. What about the perforations of the ovarian cancer?
Well, they've been a problem. There have been deaths associated with that treatment, and it's hard. People for a while thought, well, maybe it's just that those patients who are responding to treatment and it's a tumor lysis and they make it a hole in the gut as the tumor erodes and melts from the bevacizumab. But that's not always been the case. People thought, you know, those patients who did have the gastrointestinal perforations have been looked at very extensively to try to see if they could identify that group of patients who, in fact, should not get bevacizumab. But I don't think they've been very successful in helping define a profile in whom the risk is so great that you should not administer bevacizumab. Now, bevacizumab, of course, is not approved for recurrent ovarian cancer, but it is used quite extensively in an off-label situation. Also, we've seen quite dramatic responses to bevacizumab in patients who have ascites or pleural effusions. And even if the tumor may not shrink to solid tumor, sometimes the bevacizumab dries up the pleural effusions or the ascites, and consequently patients are avoided toxicity of having paracentesis and thoracentesis, and that's a quality of life issue that is important. So bevacizumab, I think, is going to be an important adjunct to treatment of this group of patients.
Now, in the advanced disease non-label situation, are you mainly using it as monotherapy or with chemotherapy?
Well, in advanced disease in previously untreated patients, some patients do not want to participate in a GOG trial because they do not want to be randomized to the control arm. They want the bevacizumab. So 2/3 of the patients will get bevacizumab either as maintenance therapy and chemotherapy or just with a chemotherapy, but 1/3 will never get bevacizumab in a trial. So some patients feel that they don't want to participate because they don't want to have the chance of getting the placebo. And, you know, I don't know how many patients are able to convince their insurance companies or convince their doctors. I suspect it is happening. We've had patients certainly come to us and say, well, they don't want to participate in that trial. They want to go for paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab.
And if a patient were to say to you, cost is not an issue, I'd like to be treated with bevacizumab in this situation, would you treat the patient off study?
Understanding that there may be the risk to treatment, I certainly would think that's a reasonable approach.
And again, which of the arms do you think you would follow?
So I for sure would use it with the chemotherapy because that's where it's been shown to be effective in other solid tumors. But because of the single agent in a GOG study, it also had such a long stabilization disease in many patients. I certainly would not have any problems if the patient was tolerating the treatment, continue with again, cost is no object, and that's easy to say because it is an object in many patients that use some maintenance therapy for a while.
Yeah, it's been difficult. Of course, we've been dealing with bevacizumab in lung and colon, breast, renal cell, and obviously the cost and reimbursement is always an issue, but we're also trying to sort of distill out the clinical science.
Right.
What do we know about angiogenesis and VEGF specifically with ovarian?
Well, we've looked at microvessel density, and we've looked at those factors which we think are predictive of possibly response to VEGF, and there are prognostic signs. It's hard. People looking at blood vessel flow and some of that technology with the MRIs is giving us some hints. But I think angiogenesis is an important factor in ovarian cancer. And I think that the bevacizumab, if I had to bet, I would bet that the bevacizumab trial will be positive.
Interesting. What else has been seen in terms of side effects and toxicity with bevacizumab? The usual hypertension, et cetera?
Right.
Anything else unusual?
I think some of the vascular phenomena you can still see, but it's primarily the hypertension.
What are some of the other options that are being looked into and that you consider in the advanced disease setting, particularly new agents that are being looked at that you think are encouraging?
Well, a lot of the drugs that you mentioned that have been looked at that have had some activity, the multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors are being studied and they're going to be looked at. There was one reported at ASCO. It's a targeted oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor of VEGFR and PDGF and c-KIT, and that was reported to have a response rate as far as CA125 reductions in a substantial number of patients. So it appears that these drugs may have some benefit, and hopefully the angiogenesis treatment will lead to more easily administered drugs. Oral drugs, I think, ultimately will be better. There's some phase 1 data from the National Cancer Institute that Elise Cohn was looking at, combinations of bevacizumab and sorafenib, and she was reporting some very dramatic responses, but with some significant toxicity from both drugs, so they required dose reductions. But that may be the future as well, to try to combine some of these. There's some mTOR inhibitors that are going to be studied because mTOR activation, AKT activation is also present in ovarian cancer. So, you know, it's not unique to ovarian cancer, the pathways that are also amplified in many other solid tumors. So the drugs that are being used in other solid tumors, the molecular targeted therapies, are certainly being used in ovarian cancer as well and studied. I think lapatinib is being studied as well in some trials, but there's no data yet on those agents.
What do we know specifically, if anything, about sunitinib or sorafenib in ovarian?
We don't know really much about how active they are. You know, all the Tarceva had some activity with some response rates in low numbers. Gleevec was looked at and had, I don't think, any responses in the GOG as such. Iressa had an occasional response associated with EGFR mutation. These drugs do have some activity. Cetuximab was looked at. It probably is not going to be an active agent. So we're looking at all of these agents. They're not going to be universally active on all solid tumors, but there are clearly going to be some different specificities, but we're going to probably be testing them all. Obviously, ideally, we'd like to be able to have molecular markers predict which of these drugs may have a better likelihood of response and do genetic profiling and microarray analysis. Try to use up and down regulation of RNA patterns to see which patients may benefit from which particular treatment, but we're not there yet.
You mentioned EGFR mutations. Are there EGFR mutations in the tumor itself, the way you see it in non-small cell lung?
Well, we only found one in about 35 or 37 ovarian cancer patients, and that was the one patient that did respond.
And that was to Tarceva?
That was to Iressa.
Interesting. Was it a dramatic long-standing response?
I think primarily with long, stable disease.
You mentioned the GOG trial of bevacizumab. What other studies are out there, and specifically, what do we know about activity of bevacizumab from other studies in addition to that one?
Well, we know from, again, as a single agent, bevacizumab in the GOG study had roughly about a 20% response rate. There have been several other studies that have also reported in smaller numbers that there are response rates in the neighborhood of about 10 or 15%. So it's clear that if you take all the data together, that the response rate is going to be somewhere probably between 15 and 20%. So this is unequivocally an active agent in this disease.
To what extent has the combination of chemotherapy regimens with bevacizumab been studied to this point?
It's also going to be studied in recurrent disease. In recurrent disease, the standard of care, as I mentioned, is for platinum-sensitive disease. There are two drug combinations which are used now. One is paclitaxel carboplatin, and the other one is the recently approved combination of gemcitabine and carboplatin for platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer. The FDA approved that combination on the basis of a randomized trial in Europe comparing gemcitabine carboplatin versus carboplatin, and there was a 3-month improvement in progression-free survival with a combination. And in an earlier study done by the ICON investigators in Europe, which compared paclitaxel carboplatin versus carboplatin in platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, they likewise showed an improvement in 3 months progression-free survival and a slight improvement in overall survival. So that's been a landscape change in the last couple of years, that patients who have platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer, that they should be treated with combinations. And the difference between paclitaxel carboplatin and gemcitabine carboplatin is primarily a toxicity issue, and I think both combinations would have equal efficacy. Paclitaxel carboplatin obviously have hair loss, and patients who have neuropathy, you really don't want to retreat them with that combination because you can exacerbate the neuropathy. And one of the advantages of the gemcitabine carboplatin is that it doesn't exacerbate neuropathy. In contrast, however, there is more myelosuppression with gemcitabine carboplatin. But medical oncologists very frequently use this combination in lung cancer. They know how to use it, and the consequences of the increased myelosuppression are not so great. So gemcitabine carboplatin, it's a good option in patients who have neuropathy. It's a good option in patients who have a real strong desire not to have hair loss because they won't have hair loss with that. So gemcitabine carboplatin is a very, I think, becoming more and more combination that's being used in patients with platinum-sensitive recurrent disease. And in that group of patients as well, trials are now adding bevacizumab in the recurrent disease situation. So we'll see if that makes a difference.
So do we have any data looking at chemo plus Bev?
Not in recurrent disease yet. We have at ASCO this year, they presented pertuzumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that binds several sites on the different EGFR receptor families, that drug in combination with gemcitabine appears to have some substantial activity in a phase 2 trial. So that's a lead that some of these monoclonal antibodies may be used together with chemotherapy. There's some activity. There may be some markers that can be used to predict which patients may respond to that treatment. So that study is going to be expanded. So there's some interest in that drug being developed. Tarceva has been used in some studies as sort of a maintenance therapy, and there's no data on that yet. So, you know, we need to do the randomized trial. There's some other similar angiogenesis inhibitors that are being studied in Europe in randomized trials in recurrent ovarian cancer, very much similar to the GOG study in previously untreated patients. So there are trials out there looking at these drugs, but there's no data yet from whether they really have an impact yet.
In the GOG adjuvant trial, what's the eligibility?
Well, it's interesting. The initial eligibility criteria was for suboptimal stage 3 and 4 patients with epithelial ovarian cancer as well as peritoneal cancer and fallopian tube cancer, which is also really the same disease. The reason they just wanted to include patients just with suboptimal disease because they were hoping to take patients with optimal disease and treat them on intraperitoneal therapies. But there's been a real debate about intraperitoneal therapies, and so they haven't been able to launch any randomized trials of intraperitoneal therapies. So they're going to amend the protocol, which is called GOG-218, to include patients who have optimal stage 3 disease with just some microscopic disease left. So I think that, in fact, is a good move because I think that that group of patients may theoretically even benefit more because they have very little disease and the bevacizumab may prevent regrowth. So the eligibility criteria is being increased to include more patients. As I mentioned, there's still a debate about how best to approach patients with intraperitoneal disease with small volume disease based on a GOG study, which was called 172, which published in the New England Journal a couple of years ago, actually be 2 years ago in January now, which showed a survival advantage for intraperitoneal therapy compared to intravenous therapy. But the intravenous therapy in that group, in that trial, was cisplatin and paclitaxel, and many of us have argued that that was the wrong control arm. They should use paclitaxel and carboplatin, and then the difference would not have been great and may not have been statistically significant. The intraperitoneal therapy is extremely toxic. 40% of the patients could only complete 6 cycles of therapy. A lot of neuropathy in that study, a lot of myelosuppression. So community physicians, I don't think, have accepted this treatment because of the high degree of toxicity and the fact that it may not really be better than intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel. And the GOG is still trying to figure out what kind of clinical trial to do. They've looked at some different modifications of intraperitoneal regimens to decrease toxicity, such as using intraperitoneal carboplatin instead of intraperitoneal cisplatin, lowering the dose of the cisplatin. And so the real question is, can you go back and do a large randomized trial again to see if, in fact, you can show that a less toxic intraperitoneal regimen is as good as a previous toxic regimen, and if it's really better than intravenous carboplatin paclitaxel? So unfortunately, that answer would take a long time for us to get that result.
Right now, what would you say to a woman in terms of what the prognosis is of both suboptimal and optimal disease?
Well, with a patient who presents with optimal stage 3 disease, the likelihood of her being in a clinical complete remission is about 90% after chemotherapy, either with intravenous chemotherapy or with intraperitoneal therapy. And unfortunately, the time to recurrence will be somewhere around, the median time to recurrence will be about 2 years. So even though they get into a high rate of complete remission, the median time to progression is about 2 years.
What fraction of women don't progress?
Ultimately, probably only 25% of patients will not progress.
And how about suboptimal disease?
Suboptimal patients, about 75% of patients will get into a clinical complete remission, and almost all of those patients will ultimately progress.
You mentioned pertuzumab. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that agent in ovarian cancer and what we know about HER2 in ovarian cancer?
Well, HER2 by itself, we initially thought that overexpression of HER2 would be more common than it turned out to be. The GOG did a large study and found only about 10% of patients were overexpressors, and there were only a couple of responses. So Herceptin by itself or trastuzumab is not really considered to be an active agent. Pertuzumab, it's still too early to tell whether this is going to be a useful drug. By itself, it had some responses in the study. And now, in this most recent study that reported at ASCO, combining with gemcitabine, it was relatively low, but it may be encouraging enough to continue a larger study to see whether pertuzumab in combination with chemotherapy may be useful.
What do we know specifically about pertuzumab in patients, unusual patients who do have HER2 activation?
They're looking at some biomarkers on the ratio of two of the epitopes, and I think they were trying to figure out if they could identify patients who may, in fact, have a higher response rate. And I think that may be ultimately the plan to see if you could, this is retrospective data, if you could prospectively identify patients on a basis of HER2 and HER3, I think with HER2 and 3 receptor ratios, that who may respond.
You were talking about the carbo-paclitaxel combination. What do we know about nab-paclitaxel in ovarian?
Yeah, Abraxane is clearly an active drug. I think it does have some activity. The issue is it better than or less toxic than paclitaxel carboplatin? You know, it's those kind of studies that I think individuals have a hard time saying, well, we really want to do a large randomized trial. It's unlikely to really push the frontiers forward of more cure rates, and it may be slightly less toxic, although some people would argue that. You know, there are other drugs that are being developed. There are different types of pathalone. Pathalones may be useful, but it's still unclear. There are different types of polyglutamated taxols that are being studied. Whether or not they really make a difference, I think is going to be, in my mind, that they're not going to have a major impact. It's nice to have less toxic drugs, no question. But paclitaxel plus carboplatin, again, is a pretty well-tolerated regimen. And again, there was a large nationwide trial that Lilly sponsored of paclitaxel carbo versus gem carbo in previously untreated patients. I think that study finished accrual and may be reported at ASCO this year. Now, again, that combination, I don't think it's likely to be better than paclitaxel carbo as far as the outcome goes. It may have different toxicity profile than some sets of patients who have diabetes and really at a high risk for neuropathy, that combination may be preferable. But again, those are important issues for individual patients. But as far as improving overall cure rates, I'm not optimistic that any of the drugs that are being used right now will be able to do that.
I guess there have been some hints, at least in breast cancer, maybe increased activity with NAB compared to regular paclitaxel. But I think even in breast cancer, clearly clinical research is focusing on biologics and kind of just, you know, not getting into the choice of chemo too much anymore.
Right.
What about the infrastructure to do clinical research in ovarian cancer? You have the medical oncologist, you have the gynecologic oncologist. How set up are we to get trials done? And for example, this big GOG study, do you see that the mechanisms in place to get that done in a timely fashion?
Well, never as fast as we would like. I mean, ovarian cancer is a relatively uncommon disease. There will be about 23,000 new cases this year. We probably put 3 to 5% of those previously untreated patients on clinical trial, nowhere near as good as we'd like. So it is hard to mount large trials. And we're doing studies like, the intraperitoneal study with about 200 or 300 patients per each arm, the Taxol Carbo versus Taxol Cisplatin with an 800-patient study, which took several years. So it does take time to accrue, and it takes time to follow the group and to get decisive results. So I think we're struggling with the fact that it's not that common a disease. Now, on the other hand, that's why we're also working together with international groups. The GOG is part of an international network of clinical investigators in Italy and Australia and in London and England, so that we can do international studies. And I think the large study that I told you about, where patients are randomized to a five-arm study of the paclitaxel carboplatin versus a triplet of paclitaxel carboplatin, gemcitabine, another triplet of paclitaxel carboplatin, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, and then two doublets of topotecan carboplatin and one of carboplatin gemcitabine. And those studies were done with international cooperation with 4,000 patients, and we were able to do those studies in a relatively timely manner. So we really need to do larger studies, and I think it's important to get those studies quickly.
There's been a lot of debate about the issue of how bevacizumab is actually working. Initially, it was thought to be anti-angiogenic, and then the concept of vascular normalization and potentiation of chemotherapy came up. What's your take about that debate, and how does it apply to ovarian?
I think that data was very interesting about preventing angiogenesis, or those papers of Jane, which showed that you actually just wind up perhaps just delivering more chemotherapy by improving the vasculature in the tumors. That data has not been deciphered out, which mechanism is important in ovarian cancer. The real question will be in ovarian cancer with bevacizumab, I think, will be, well, what if the study is positive, for example, dextrocarboplatin and gem and bevacizumab? And what if patients ultimately, and many will still, of course, recur? Well, should you switch to a different chemotherapy and keep the bevacizumab? Will that continue to have a benefit later on? Obviously, if a patient's on bevacizumab from the time they're treated and the bevacizumab is maintained with a different chemotherapy regimens, it will be prohibitively expensive.
Any other concerns in addition to bowel perforation in terms of bevacizumab and local problems, particularly wound healing?
I think it's actually pretty relatively well tolerated. The hypertension is manageable. Some bleeding issues, minor, but it's a relatively well-tolerated drug.
To what extent have you yourself used the drug in ovarian cancer?
Well, we use it extensively on the clinical trial, and we certainly use it. We discuss it with patients with recurrent disease, and we've used it as a single agent in patients with recurrent disease, and there have been a couple of studies. You get either the single agent or sometimes with low-dose cyclophosphamide, and it's been particularly gratifying in patients with lignocytes or pleural effusions where it's had a good palliative effect.
Do you feel that that's most likely an anti-tumor effect, or could that in some way be a vascular effect?
Well, that could be a vascular effect, because sometimes you see the ascites dry up, but nothing happening as far as CA-125 levels, and there's nothing happening as far as a solid tumor. But in that sense, it's certainly better to take a drug than to have a paracentesis and thoracentesis on a regular basis.
Any patients that you've actually taken care of that you could maybe describe where you've seen, it's one thing to try to look at numbers, particularly when there's so little data available,
right,
where you really saw something that really made a difference to a patient with bevacizumab?
I had one patient who had very extensive disease and recurred after treatment with a wide variety of different treatments, and she developed a pleural effusion that had to be tapped repeatedly, and as well as ascites. And it was very painful, and she was very uncomfortable with that. And we gave her single-agent bevacizumab, and she did not require a thoracentesis or a paracentesis for about, 6 or 7 months. So, in that time frame, she had a very improved quality of life.
What happened to her tumor markers and other tumor?
Her tumor markers never really got lower. She didn't have any sort of real measurable disease on a CT scan that we could see. So her big problem was just the ascites accumulation and the pleural accumulation. But from having a very painful distended abdomen requiring paracentesis every couple of weeks, she'd go, months without having that. And that was very, very gratifying to her.
What's the dose of Bev used?
A couple of different doses have been used. This is the 15 milligram per kilogram dose. I think, as you know, in lung cancer, the dose has been looked at, and that maybe the 7.5 is as good. And I don't think we've really explored completely the optimum dosing or the dosing that's necessary. I think the other issue that is, I think, very important for medical oncologists is dealing with the recurrent ovarian cancer problem. And most patients will recur, and then they ultimately will become resistant to platinum drugs. And now the paradigm is to use carboplatin and gemcitabine or paclitaxel. And carboplatin patients with platinum-sensitive disease, once they become resistant, then the drugs such as topotecan and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin and gemcitabine are used. And there's a lot of issues at which of those drugs to use. But when they become platinum-resistant, then fortunately the response rates are down to around 10%. So the reality is, no matter which drug you choose, it's probably not going to make much difference in the sense that you're not going to cure that group of patients, the duration of a response is going to be relatively short, and you're probably going to wind up switching to another one. So we use these drugs in sequence. We try to give patients drug holidays so that if they're asymptomatic, they can be off chemotherapy. It's always an issue of, you know, undertreating versus overtreating, and quality of life is really an important driving factor in trying to maintain these patients for as long as you can.
Can you talk about what we know about risk factors, what we know about the effect of oral contraceptives, and also what's happening in terms of vaccines?
We know that the primary risk factor is really the family history of the disease, and particularly the biggest risk factor is patients who have mutations of BRCA1 or BRCA2, and they're part of the breast ovarian cancer syndrome. And the lifetime risk for ovarian cancer in the general population is 1 in 70. But those patients who carry those mutations, again, depending on which specific mutation they have, their lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer may be as high as 60%. The approach to the patients who are BRCA1 positive or BRCA2 positive is really the current approach is to recommend a prophylactic oophorectomy in those group of patients after they have finished childbearing and usually around 35 years of age. That prophylactic oophorectomy will decrease their risk of ovarian cancer. They still have a risk of developing a peritoneal disease, which mimics ovarian cancer, and it also decreases the risk of breast cancer. So prophylactic oophorectomy is an important part of management of patients with hereditary ovarian cancer. There are some interesting new drugs that are being developed for this group of patients. BRCA1 and 2 are involved in DNA repair, and when patients who have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, they have one allele, of course, that is still functioning, and so they can still deal with damage to the DNA. But in the tumors, when there's no real functioning of one or two or both alleles, those patients, that's where the tumor develops. And there are drugs which inhibit some other repair mechanisms, which sometimes the cells use, so they have no repair at all with drugs called PARP inhibitors, P-A-R-P inhibitors. These drugs may be quite active, and phase 1 studies are in progress, and phase 2 studies in patients who have disease that is BRCA1 or BRCA2 positive. Initial results are encouraging. So we may have something that specifically treats those patients, and this type of a drug ultimately may also prove to be a good prevention strategy for BRCA1 and BRCA2 carriers. But for the general population who are just at average risk, there are some risk factors. Again, having children, being on oral contraceptives decreases your risk. Having children decreases your risk, and anything that decreases your ovulatory cycles, the number of ovulatory cycles, will decrease your risk. And that's where oral contraceptives either decrease the ovulatory cycles or the progestational part of the oral contraceptive may induce apoptosis in some of the epithelial cells, which are on the verge of perhaps transforming. So there's a couple of mechanisms how oral contraceptive pills may decrease risk.
You mentioned the PARP inhibitors. What's the mechanism of action?
When these cells are completely deficient in DNA repair mutations, that's where both alleles are not functioning and the tumor develops. But they still need some type of repair mechanisms that may help that cell, even that tumor cell, survive some damage. And consequently, if you block any other repair mechanism with a PARP inhibitor, and this is a polyribose, it's an excision repair enzyme, and if you block that, which is the tumor cells apparently need to try to repair any damages themselves, that makes them very vulnerable to apoptosis and they die.
Now, is the biology in response to agents, including, for example, these PARP inhibitors, pretty much the same in sporadic and genetic, or are they sort of different biologically?
Well, in sporadic tumors, they don't have the mutations of the BRCA1 or BRCA2, so the DNA repair is not a problem in sporadic tumors. So the PARP inhibitors probably will work only or will work a lot better in patients who have the mutations of those genes.
What's the age distribution of ovarian cancer, again, sporadic and genetic?
Well, the sporadic is probably in the 60s. The important factor about BRCA1, BRCA2, it occurs a lot earlier in women and usually in their 40s and early 50s. And the sporadic form occurs in much older women.
And you mentioned a peritoneal type of process that occurs in women who've had oophorectomies. What is that?
Well, it's called primary peritoneal carcinomatosis. And, you know, the entire perineum can be at risk for this disease. And sometimes it's difficult to tell whether you have a primary peritoneal carcinomatosis, where the disease starts in the cells in the perineum, which are basically in contiguity with the cells on the surface of the ovary, which are the cells that actually lead then to invasive ovarian cancer. And so you can have ovaries present, and most of the disease is on the surface of the ovary, but it's spread throughout the peritoneal cavity, and it acts just like ovarian cancer. And consequently, even at times when the ovaries are removed, you can develop a primary peritoneal cancer, which acts biologically just like ovarian cancer. It's the same probably cell type that is involved, and the same risk factors would probably apply for that disease as well. The disease, again, would present with intraperitoneal disease at multiple sites and ascites and pleural effusions and so forth. And it'll have elevated CA125s, and the approach to primary peritoneal carcinomatosis is really the same as that for ovarian cancer.
Interesting. What about vaccines?
Well, there are some therapeutic vaccines, but there aren't any preventive vaccines that really have been shown to have any utility at this point. People have tried to develop some vaccines where they've taken patient's own tumor and chemically modified it, injected it back, but none of those have really proven to be useful. So vaccines, people are looking at dendritic cell vaccines and, again, in heavily treated patients, but these are phase one studies. They're difficult to do. There really isn't any evidence yet that a vaccine can prevent the disease or some vaccine can be used to treat the disease.
You also mentioned the issue of early detection. I know transvaginal sonography and tumor markers have been looked at.
There's a lot of work being done in that regard. CA125 has proven not to be useful by itself because there's so many false positives. Where we're faced with an issue in screening for this disease, first of all, it's relatively uncommon. It starts to take off in postmenopausal women, and the incidence in postmenopausal women is 1 in 2,500. So you have to screen 2,500 women to pick up one case of ovarian cancer. So you have to have both sensitivity and specificity. You don't want to miss any ovarian cancers. That would be the sensitivity, but you also have to have a very high specificity, which means that you have very few false positives. For example, if some tests said that this specificity was 95%, that sounds sort of good, but the reality is, that's 5% of the time you'd be wrong, and 5% of 2,500, you'd be doing an awful lot of unnecessary laparotomies to try to pick up one case of ovarian cancer. So it's a numbers game that is very difficult, and so we need very specific tests that don't make us operate on a woman unnecessarily because we think she has ovarian cancer. So CA125s by themselves, if you just walk down the street here and measure CA125s, then you'd have to operate on at least 70 women to pick up one case of ovarian cancer, and that's certainly not useful because you'd run the risk of actually doing more harm than good. So people are looking at now serial CA125s, for example, that you don't act upon an individual CA125. If it's elevated, you measure it again in 6 months and see if it's still going up. And that type of algorithm may be useful. It's still being tested. People are also looking at other markers, other biomarkers instead of CA125, and panels of biomarkers are being studied and looked at. Again, right now, there's no evidence that they are useful. And finally, people are also looking at proteomics, which is looking at the protein fragment patterns in the blood of patients who may have the disease. And for a while, there was some flurry of excitement. The proteomic pattern may be more sensitive and specific, but that has not yet been confirmed. So yes, there's a lot of work being done on earlier detection, but right now there's no technique that has proven to be useful.
What's new in terms of staging of patients?
Well, in staging, the important thing is to have a comprehensive staging laparotomy, and that's why it's really essential that if you suspect ovarian cancer, that the patient be referred to a gynecologic oncologist who's expert in surgical staging, because in that subset of patients with stage 1 disease, where the disease is confined to the ovaries, and depending on other clinical pathologic factors, there's a group of patients in whom no chemotherapy is needed because their relapse rate will be less than 5%. So you have to be very clear that patients, for example, who have just stage 1 disease where the tumor is just in the ovaries and it's grade 1 or grade 2, there's some debate about grade 2, but if it's a grade 1 tumor and there's no other sites of disease, then there's no adjuvant therapies necessary. On the other hand, if there's some adverse risk factors such as high-grade tumor or grade 3 tumor, or if there's spillage of a ruptured capsule or a cyst that contains cells, that puts you at high risk of recurrence. If there's a tumor on the surface of the ovary or if there's ascites or positive peritoneal washings, those patients are considered early-stage high-risk, and we recommend that that group of patients get immediate chemotherapy because clinical trials have shown that in that group of patients, there's an improvement in survival of about 8%. So we still have to treat a lot, and their survival is well over 80%. But some patients aren't still cured by this treatment because there are some groups of patients, such as patients with clear cell cancers, who do very poorly, even though they may be confined just to the ovaries. So there's different subtypes of patients that are still not doing well. And specifically in tumors like clear cell, which is one of the variants of epithelial ovarian cancer, it appeared that this very much may be a very different tumor with a different genetic fingerprint. And perhaps we should be treating those clear cell tumors with a different regimen, as well as mucinous tumors, because they don't respond as well and do as well as the classic serous and endometrioid tumors of the ovary. So in an early stage, we know we're doing very well. I mean, even with the high-risk patients, maybe only 20% of the patients are dying of their disease. But it's difficult to do studies in this group of patients because they're relatively uncommon. Their prognosis is good, and you have to follow them for a long period of time to see if you make any impact. So I'm not sure we're going to be able to do any more studies in that group of patients, and maybe we'll include that group of patients with high-risk features in early stage in our clinical trial of advanced-stage patients.
What about prognostic factors and specifically pretreatment, CA-125? You published on that. What do we know about that?
Well, the higher level of CA-125, that's an adverse prognostic factor, and certainly the other classic adverse prognostic factors are the volume of disease, the stage of the disease, performance status of the patient. So those are really things that we take into account. Now, if they have extensive ascites, that's an adverse factor. It's an adverse factor for an attempt to try to reduce those patients. So again, bulk of disease is grade of the disease, sites of the disease, total amount of the disease, performance status are the key factors.